I'd like to talk about this idea of God or higher power and see if we can make some sense of it in a Buddhist context. And the inspiration to kind of put a lot of these ideas together is a Buddhist monk named Ajahn Buddhadasa, who is probably best known for his book on the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness of breathing or mindfulness with breathing. And Buddhadasa was something of an iconoclast in the Thai culture. I think he was somewhat ostracized from Bangkok, the monastic world there, and sort of set out on his own and eventually became quite popular and well-known internationally. Died about 20 years ago. He was known for having a meditation hall that had no Buddhas in it. And he was also known for his interest in what we would call now interfaith dialogue. And in 1967, he gave a series of talks about Christianity and Buddhism. It was long since out of print, but I managed to get a copy of it after someone pointed me to it some years ago. So there's a few things from that text I'd like to read and then talk about. He says, as long as people insist that God is a person in the conventional sense of people language, we can say that they will not know the real God, which in turn leads to proselytizing, disagreements, clashes, and conflicts. The intellectuals will increasingly deny this ordinary kind of God, and it will not be very long before people educated in the modern way will have eliminated God from their hearts altogether. Sounds like a pretty accurate description of Western culture today. It says, God in people language is simply a conventional word which is used when speaking to children. It is also used by adults who, being intellectually immature, feel and think like children. He doesn't pull punches. They will use the word God in that way until their awareness and wisdom mature enough for them to understand finally the meaning of God according to Dharma language. He says, God in people language always has the Dharma language hidden within. And something of equal importance to observe and understand is that every religion has something that can be called God, but that some religions talk about their God only in terms of Dharma language. And thus, it appears that those religions have no God, and so they are classified as non-theistic religions. Buddhism and Jainism are religions of this type. Another group of religions mostly uses easily understandable conventional language when talking about God, and so they are classified as theistic religions. Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, and Judaism are examples of this type. Religions of this latter group have very profound things to say about God in terms of Dharma language, but they are hidden under the outer shell and form of those religions. The classification of religions into two groups, non-theistic and theistic, is a superficial classification that does not touch the real essence or meaning of religion. Consequently, we continue to do so, however, because people are only able to understand things superficially and thus are unable to penetrate the heart of religion. Many of them come to despise religion more and more, especially what is called God. Finally, some declare that they have no religion and are proud to be atheists. So it's really a provocative idea that he's setting forth here, that all religions have this Dharma God within them. And so I should talk a bit about what this word means, Dharma. He's actually using the word dhamma, which is another version of that word. So dharma means, in the most broad sense, truth. When we're talking about Buddhism, we're talking about the Buddha Dharma, or the truth as the Buddha taught it. And the Buddha taught the Dharma. It's not suggested that the Buddha made up the Dharma, but rather that he discovered the Dharma, or he had insight into the Dharma. So it, as with many of the words we encounter in Buddhism, our Western translation isn't so accurate. We can't simply define it, but I'll say sometimes besides truth, it's defined as the natural law. In the Thai forest tradition, they'll say the truth of the way things are. But it encompasses certain ideas, and this is really what my second book is about, is taking some of the specifics of the Dharma and talking about how they are powers. But I'll also say that I really, I mentioned the word theistic this morning and sort of said, I'll talk a little bit more about it. And this, where he says the classification of religions into non-theistic and theistic is a superficial classification. Much in the way that I was talking about internal and external, it doesn't, when you really start to look at the meaning of God beyond the superficial ideas, this kind of classifications break down. So, one person who's done a lot of exploration around these ideas is Karen Armstrong, who wrote A History of God, which is a pretty interesting book, and also The Case for God. And if you're interested in this, this is another place that I went to for some of my, to sort of get a better understanding of these questions. And one of the things that you find in The Case for God is she talks about sort of, I guess in The History of God she does this too, but that over time, the meaning of a word like God has really, really changes a great deal. And in our bubble of our present-day culture where we think, this is the way things are, sort of, God has always meant this, you discover that it's not really the case. And that particularly because we have this very strong fundamentalist Christian streak now in Western culture, which has kind of hijacked the word God. And I think that's one of the main reasons why we have such a strong atheistic movement now, is the way that God has been hijacked by fundamentalists, limiting the idea of the meaning so much down to this faith-based concept of some patriarch in the sky, some guy up there who's controlling things. And that this idea of an external God who, is pulling the strings is really not an idea that's ever been accepted as among serious either scholars or theologians or people immersed in religion, from mystics, Christian mystics to Hindu mystics. I mean, it's just sort of it's somewhat of a modern idea, this, and one that really misses the point, and I think is really alienating. And again, he makes this point that it's a way of talking to children, and that some people just never grow up spiritually. And this is pretty tough talk, but ultimately, I have to say that I agree with that. And it's, you know, these ideas, these fundamentalist ideas are, again, things that people take refuge in out of fear, not out of any kind of sophisticated exploration or even personal experience. You know, but also I will say that people, I should get off the critique of fundamentalism, but I'll say one more thing, that people, to move it a little bit out of this is to say that, you know, people put their spiritual experience into the language and imagery that they know. So when people have a spiritual experience, if they've been raised with a certain type of language and imagery, they're going to describe it in those terms. And in fact, there's a book we studied actually in the CDL about enlightenment. And it was essentially saying that people who have enlightenment experiences in different religions actually have the experiences they have align with their religion, because that's how they're conditioned. So Christians have this sort of vision of Christ, and Buddhists have this feeling of emptiness, and you know, just it kind of manifests in the way that they're conditioned. Well, I want to get more into this idea of what a Dharma God might mean. Because it's not quite enough to just say Dharma God, because that's somewhat still a very broad, kind of vague idea. But I'll say, just to complete this idea, that the word God has taken on different meanings at different times. Karen Armstrong says that early Christians were considered to be atheists by the pagans of the time, because the pagans would say, well, you know, where is your God? Our God is the sun and the sky and the rain and the earth. Where's your God? Well, our God, you can't see our God. Our God is something just inside. It's something, you know, and what are you talking about? That's not God. You guys are atheists. So, as I was writing this book, you know, my goal wasn't really to define God, frankly, because it is a, you know, somewhat of a quagmire to enter into. I'm not a theologian, and I'm sure I could be shot down and, you know, debated into the earth by any serious philosopher or theologian. But what the question I found myself asking throughout the writing of this book is, how does a particular aspect of the Dharma fit into the concept of something that I would turn my will and my life over to? What would it mean to turn my will and my life over to that? So I set out by trying to define these aspects of the Dharma as powers, and then see them as things that I would try to live in accordance with. So I started by the what I consider to be the greatest power that the Buddha talked about, and that's the power of karma. I'm going to read some. Each of these chapters has a small sentence or a couple of sentences that define this higher power. So the higher power of karma brings results from actions based on the moral fabric of the universe. So this is one of the critical ideas in Buddhism, that, you know, many people accept, probably most people accept the idea that cause and effect is a truth, that there is a, that everything has a cause. But what's added to that in religion, and certainly in Buddhism, is that certain causes have a moral component, that causes have a moral component to them, and that there are the results of them then will be related to the moral aspect of those actions. Now, this is speaking in relative terms, because, you know, we're talking about morality is, by its nature, dualistic. So that, you know, I'll put it in terms of good and bad. For instance, we would typically say that, well, it's, if we know someone and we die, and they die, if we die, we don't know anybody, and they die, we think, well, that was a bad thing. If we love them, that was bad that they died. But in terms of the bigger picture of the universe, death isn't a bad thing. Right? It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just the way things are. There's no moral component to it, or good or bad component to it. And in fact, if no one died, we'd have a much bigger problem. That would be bad in terms of survival of the planet. You know, we'd get overcrowded, more overcrowded, and we wouldn't be able to sustain ourselves. So death is a good thing from that viewpoint, right? So good, bad, it depends on where you're standing. You know, it's bad if somebody steals money from me, but it's good for them because now they have more money. You know, so, but from a Buddhist standpoint, there's a moral component to the stealing, right? There isn't a moral component to the dying. Okay, so karma is the force behind addiction, recovery, and spiritual growth. We use this power to transform ourselves and our world through intentional thoughts, words, and actions. So, of course, addiction comes about because we do something over and over. And one of the principles of karma is that the more you do something, the stronger the tendency to do that becomes. The less you do something, the weaker the tendency to do that becomes. So addiction happens because we do something, I enjoy that, I think I'll do it again. We do it again. It goes from being something we do because we want to something we are driven to do, and eventually to which we feel compelled to do. That is, we are as though we were under the thumb of a dictator, a dictator. And recovery is also the result of karma, is also how we recover, by taking certain actions that bring about certain results. And the essence of karma is that actions have results. I think sometimes we lose that simple idea. So we use this power to transform ourselves and our world through intentional thoughts, words, and actions. So this is one of the keys that the Buddha talked about with karma. The idea of karma existed already in India at the time he was teaching. But it was seen as something very mechanistic that was just cause actions bring results. What the Buddha saw is that the intention or the motivation behind your action is what actually informs the quality of the results of the action. So, for instance, with the dana that I talked about, if you give dana with a sense of stinginess, like, oh, I'll give a dollar, sure, I'll give a dollar, and you can afford much more, then the karmic results for you emotionally are the sense of constriction, right? And perhaps even guilt or resentment that, why are they asking me for money anyway? Ah, these greedy, you know, spiritual teachers, they're all just trying to pick my pocket. So now this doesn't, you know, what are the longer term karmic effects? I don't know. And there's teachings about these kind of things, about, you know, if you're generous, you'll become rich in your next lifetime. I mean, that's very convenient for the people. But, you know, And if you're loving, you'll be beautiful in your next lifetime. Great, but you know, what about now? Well, what I know about now is what I feel. So what I'm actually more interested in than these kind of long-term effects of karma is, what's the immediate impact of an action I take? And that, so I call that the emotional karma. So the intention, someone else could come up, they have $2 in their pocket, they give $1. Like, oh, I really want to support this, I really want to give $1. And it's this real action of letting go and kind of joy, and they walk away feeling very good that they really did their best. The two people gave the exact same amount of money, but the karmic result for each of them is completely different because of the intention behind it, with the motivation that was driving them. So this is why the Buddha says, explore your intention before you take an action. Because you can look good. It can look like you're doing the right thing, but actually you're just doing it to get the tax break. You know, you can.
Well, I'm a doctor. You know, I do this because I really want to help the world and because I'm getting rich on the side. Of course, I don't think you can get rich being a doctor, can you? Is that somewhat? I don't know. Maybe you can. Certainly in the States you can.
I also think it's important to recognize that when we talk about cause and effect as actions bring results, there are three categories of actions, and they include thoughts and words and deeds. So it's kind of scary to think that your thoughts have a karmic impact. Most of the thoughts that we have are the results of past thoughts, words, and deeds. But one of the reasons that we watch our mind as Buddhist practitioners is to start to have more intentionality in our thinking. To start to see that, oh, I don't have to buy it. It's not so much that you're responsible, like, oh man, I had a moment when I wanted to kill somebody. It's like these things just come up, right, that we're powerless over. But then there's the more intentional thoughts where we're really saying, okay, I want to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm planning this. And then you can see that, okay, that's really going to have karmic impact. In one sutta, the Buddha says that if you practice in this way, you will become a master of the courses of thought, which the way I understand that is that means that I'm able to guide my thinking, the courses, the movement of my thought. I become a master of that instead of being the slave to my own thinking that we most of us feel we are. It's also interesting that he says this because another kind of misunderstanding of Buddhist practice is that what I'm trying to learn to do is to stop thinking. Right? People hear the meditation instructions that say, when you have a thought, let go of the thought and come back to your breath. And then what we infer from that is, oh, I'm not supposed to think. Thinking is bad. The point of meditation is to stop thinking. Oh yeah, I just was sitting there and all my thoughts left away and it was a beautiful empty space. Well, yeah. That's lovely when that can happen. But it's not what we're trying to get at. Because thinking is going to happen. Yeah, there are moments when you can quiet that and maybe you can get more control over that. But it's more important to be able to see your thoughts and to change how you relate to your thoughts so that your thoughts aren't just controlling you. So, to say a little bit more about karma, the law of karma is the foundation of all the Buddha's practices. Everything that he taught in terms of what you should do is based on the law of karma. And he said that people would come to him. At that time, there were various different beliefs about how the world worked. And remarkably, many of them are similar to ones that people still have. For instance, some people believed that everything was fated. Everything was preordained. and that you had no control over how your life unfolded. And there's people who believe that today, right? There's still various religions that sort of take on these kind of belief systems. And the Buddha said, if it were not possible for you to change and to grow and to become enlightened, I wouldn't teach you this stuff. And the reason it's possible for you to change and to grow and to become enlightened is because there is cause and effect. You can take actions, intentional actions, which can ultimately transform you. So now this is what I'm going to suggest that you do, is what he said. And so that, so he taught the Eightfold Path and the Brahmaviharas, the teachings of loving kindness, compassion. Now the second power that I talk about is the higher power of mindfulness, since it's really the crowning jewel of the Buddhist practices, teachings. The higher power of mindfulness is the power of attention and non-reactivity. It opens us to wisdom and insight through clear seeing. Mindfulness is the foundation of all spiritual growth as it reveals the truth of the way things are, internally and externally. So it's this power of being able to see and to not have to act that gives us that control that I talked about this morning. It opens us to wisdom and insight through clear seeing. So it's only by being present and looking that we can actually see the truth. And we can't really get anywhere on a spiritual path if we can't start to pay attention. And I would say that this runs through the 12 steps as well. We talk about rigorous honesty, you know, and rigorous honesty means seeing the truth, seeing what is true. When we say we admitted we were powerless over whatever we admitted we were powerless over, we're being aware of that. Denial is not seeing the truth. Coming out of denial is awareness, seeing the way things are. So this is inherent to that. The searching and fearless moral inventory, again, is a kind of self-examination that requires mindfulness, that requires awareness. I talk now about the rest of the Eightfold Path, maybe a little bit more briefly. I know this is a talk that can go on. Mindfulness is an aspect of the Eightfold Path. I give it kind of a separate chapter because of its importance and because it's so obviously a power. But traditionally, the Eightfold Path starts with right view. So right view sees the truth and inspires us to follow the path. It connects suffering and its cause, showing us the root of our problem. It sees that actions bring results, thus inspiring us to live wholesomely, guided by spiritual principles. When perfected, right view is synonymous with enlightenment. So right view is actually the beginning and the end of the path. When we need to have a certain amount of right view to get started. So in the 12 steps, we call this a moment of clarity, which eventually, once we work the 12 steps, becomes a spiritual awakening. It's the same thing. It's being fully awake. So traditionally, right view is seen as understanding the Four Noble Truths, which I can't believe I haven't talked about yet. The Four Noble Truths were the first thing that the Buddha taught, and they run through his teachings, throughout his teaching career. They are the truth of suffering, the truth that there is suffering in life, that a certain amount of suffering is inevitable, and then a certain amount of it is more our own responsibility that we create it.
And the second noble truth kind of says that the suffering that we create is created by our craving. The obvious connection to the 12 steps to recovery. That our craving for pleasure, our craving for ego gratification, even our craving to turn everything off, that these forms of craving are really what cause suffering, which, you know, is counter to our instinct, which tells us that in order to be happy, I need to get the things that I want. And what the Buddha said is, actually, it's your wanting that makes you unhappy. It's not the lack of the thing. This was one of his brilliant insights, maybe the most important one. Certainly for me, I think it is the most important. And so he's asking us to look at that. And so right view is seeing that for ourselves. It's not reading about it in a book. It's having the experience of seeing, oh, I feel this longing. And the longing is what's painful. And of course, this is something that mostly is only understood by people who have been alive for a little while, like a few decades at least. Because we have to kind of play it out. We have to see that it doesn't work. And again, this is something that addicts really get, right? It's not theoretical. It's not just like a nice idea. It's so clear that our craving is what caused us suffering. Not just the addictive behavior, but the feeling of emptiness or longing or lack that drove it. And that eventually is what our recovery has to be about, right? For it to be meaningful and to grow into a really satisfying life. So right view connects suffering and its cause. So the third noble truth, sorry, I should finish that one. The third noble truth is essentially the realization that if I do let go, then their freedom must be possible, because what's causing my enslavement is this clinging, craving. And then the fourth noble truth is the way to end suffering, and that is the Eightfold Path. So, of course, Buddhism is has been preserved through a great number of lists. And you can actually sort of diagram the teachings. It's one of the things I kind of like to do. So you have the Four Noble Truths, and then you have a branch that goes off of the Eightfold Path. And each of the elements of the Eightfold Path have branches, like right effort, the four great efforts. Right mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness. Right action, the five precepts. And so it's kind of branching off, one way of viewing it, if that's a helpful visual for you. So we've now done one of the things that happens in Buddhism, which is that we've looped back on ourself. Because right view, which is the beginning of the Eightfold Path, tells you that right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths. And the Eightfold Path is part of the Four Noble Truths. Okay. So right view sees suffering in its cause, the Four Noble Truths, and it sees that actions bring results. So the other thing about right view is that it's understanding the law of karma. So it inspires us to live wholesomely. Right? It inspires us to follow the path. So that's one of the ways that we can think of right view, although the Eightfold Path is not truly linear, like the 12 steps can be done in a linear fashion. Nonetheless, we can look at it as this process where we kind of start by kind of waking up a little bit or having our moment of clarity, and then we are inspired to set off on this path, so that the second aspect of the Eightfold Path is right intention. A right intention gives clarity, direction, and resolve on the path. With right intention, we are never entirely lost, no matter how much we stray. Right intention guides us back to ourselves and the values of kindness and wisdom. Now, for me, this is one of the great consolations of the path, that I may screw up. Ha ha. Maybe, just possibly. I may make mistakes, internally and externally. My mind may wander from the breath, but I can always come back. I mean, you can even, you know, you can relapse, but you know, what do we say at meetings? Keep coming back, you know, and that's because, you know, your intention is just keep at it. And it's also a way in which, you know, when we do make mistakes, when we say the wrong thing or act unskillfully, we can kind of, it can help us to be maybe forgiving of ourselves, to know, I got caught up in my stuff, or I got overwhelmed by obsession, or I got angry, but it's not who I really want to be. And I know who I want to be, and it brings me back to that safe place. So the next three aspects of the Eightfold Path are considered the ethics, morality, the integrity aspects, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right speech transforms our relationships, bringing harmony into social interactions. Through the power of speech, we heal our wounds and give of our wisdom. So, you know, we probably wouldn't typically talk about speech as a higher power. And yet, think about how powerful speech is. It's what, where politicians mostly get their power, through their use of language. It can be used in very positive ways, the Martin Luther King or a Gandhi. It can be used in very negative ways, a Hitler, a Stalin, you know, people who could make speeches, who could practically hypnotize their audience into doing, you know, unspeakable things. So speech is very powerful. And we see it in our own lives. Our relationships are largely, certainly not entirely, but a big part of our relationships is about how we talk to each other. And so learning to do that in a skillful way really has a huge impact on our lives. So I realize I'm not talking quite... I meant to talk a little bit more about how each of these fits with step three. So this is again just saying, you know, I turn my will and my life over to the power of right speech. Just means to me that I make a commitment to try to speak in this way. And what it implies, and what step three implies, is that my impulse is going to be selfishness, self-centeredness, pleasure-seeking. You know, I, me, mine. And that I've learned that using those principles as the guides for my life destroy my life, you know, and in very real ways, and literally can kill me. And so that to turn my will and my life over means that I have to move away from my impulse, what drives me, those greed tendencies, those hate tendencies that are so strong. And I do think that for addicts, just to say, yes, all human beings have these tendencies, obviously, and the Buddha certainly talks about these things not as being about addicts, but about being human. But I do think that many addicts, at least, have stronger elements of these greed, hatred, and delusion poisons. And it's a little bit more work for us, which is why we have this other program besides the Eightfold Path, to really highlight this, that turning your will and your life over means you've got to make that commitment to do it, because you're going to, otherwise you just kind of, you don't know where to turn, you don't really have that capacity. This gives us a very clear guide to how we want to live. And that's, again, why Buddhism is so precious, because it's so precise. The Buddha was, you know, he was not vague. He can be accused of a lot of things. Vagueness is not one of them. He was very specific about how we needed to speak, how we needed to live. He gives instructions to parents, to children, to his monks. And so we have these guidelines that we try to live by, always remembering that we are going to fail, but remembering too the power of intention.
And that even if we fail, if our intention is good, that we will get back on track and we will continue to move forward and to grow in the right direction. So then we come to right action, which is the five precepts, often overlooked in the mainstream Buddhist world as kind of, oh, well, everybody knows this kind of thing. Right action triggers the power of karma. It is a simple guide to God's will and puts us in harmony with the moral fabric of the universe. Right action transforms our relationships with others by building trust and unity. It transforms our relationship with ourselves by building self-esteem, blamelessness, and clarity. So the five precepts are to not kill, to not steal, to not harm with our sexuality, to not harm with our speech, and to not use intoxicants. And so when we live this way, we feel better about ourselves. You know, that's the emotional karma that comes by behaving this way. And other people feel better about us. People trust us. Good things tend to happen. You know, our lives tend to unfold in more harmonious ways. You know, just, I love reading like crime fiction. I read a lot of detective stuff and spy things, and you know, things never work out for the killers. They just don't. They're rarely happy. They rarely live to be live out a full life. And, you know, and it's just true, you know. I mean, even, and people will say, yeah, but some people get away with crimes, like, externally, maybe. But internally, I don't think so. I had an experience it was very moving and difficult, actually, when someone came up to me at Spirit Rock one evening after the class and said, I'm having a really hard time in the meditation. My mind seems to just go into this very dark place. I said, well, you know, what's going on? Well, I'm in the military. I said, oh, that's interesting. And, yeah, and I guide drones. It's my job is to guide drones. Well, you know what the drones do? They go and they kill people. But of course, you know, this is just your job. You're just running this video game, seemingly, you know. I kind of took a deep breath and had to, you know, go, okay, you know, here I am. Here is this woman. Actually, it was a woman. And what can I say that's going to be helpful? You know, am I going to say, well, the Buddhist teachings are very clear. You know, you're killing people. That's bad. You know, you got to stop doing that. I didn't think that was going to be helpful. I didn't think she was going to kind of go and quit the military. Not that she probably could. And I just felt tremendous compassion for her, because clearly she didn't mean to be doing something harmful. You know, people join the military for all kinds of reasons, but it's usually not because they want to kill people. I mean, I guess there probably are some people who want to. But, you know, I'd say the most normal people who join the military do it probably because they need a job, or because they feel it's something their family did, or it feels like service to their country. And, you know, they're all admirable reasons. But here she is in this position, doing something that, from my viewpoint, was immoral, frankly. You know, I mean, I can't put it in any other terms. And that's not to say that I haven't ever done anything that was immoral. So, not setting myself above her, but so what I said to her actually is, just keep looking at that. You know, just really try to be with those feelings as much as you can. Very gently, and you know, just see, keep looking at what comes up, because the principle of both Buddhism and recovery is that we have to find the answers for ourselves. People can't just tell us what we should do, but that from a Buddhist standpoint,
if we hope that if we point someone in the right direction and they use the tool of awareness, that the truth will reveal itself to them. And it just kind of came up. And it just struck me as the karma that's tied up with something that really, in some ways it wasn't intentional for her, but nonetheless there was, there was the intention to join and to do this. So, moving right along, I've depressed myself now, so. I'm gonna move to some other. Well, I'm gonna try to move through the rest of this fairly briefly, just to say that, right livelihood, again, we can see as very powerful. What we do in our work is very important. It's not just secondary to our spiritual life. Well, I guess that's kind of comes up. That's what I was just talking about, her livelihood, right? So our choice of work, is not seen as neutral by the Buddha. It's very much, what are we doing in the world? And we can see how powerful that is, and that, rather than just aimlessly or mindlessly following whatever job comes along, to kind of make choices that are going to be skillful. It has tremendous impact. The last three aspects of the Eightfold Path are the meditation elements, the right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. It's interesting to think of the idea of turning your will and your life over to the care of effort. How do you do that? Very mindfully. Because we know how effort sounds like something that's about me and what I want. And so how do I make an effort without grasping? This is something Suzuki Roshi in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he says this is the secret of practice. Period. He doesn't tell you how to do it. And really, that's why I say it takes mindfulness to see what is the quality of effort I am making in this moment. Is it a grasping effort? Is it an aversive effort? Or is it an open, surrendering effort? Or a sense of trusting in my effort? Very tricky. One of the most difficult things in practice, right effort. And it's the thing, when people are on retreat, and they're really getting down to it, day after day, week after week, the big question very often becomes, what is the right, how should I make effort in this moment, moment by moment, without grasping? Right mindfulness, I've talked about right concentration. Concentration, I think, is the most powerful element of the human mind. I'm saying that in this moment. It's the thing that gives us the capacity to think deeply. In meditation practice, it is the thing that causes the most frustration. And when people try to establish a daily practice, usually the biggest frustration is the fact that they can't get their mind to quiet down. And that's the lack, what we would call the lack of concentration. A more gentle term is calm abiding. And I like that because concentration in our culture is kind of like looking really closely and just not moving and holding your attention somewhere, and that kind of ties into this, I'm supposed to stop thinking. But in Buddhism, what we're really talking about is getting ourselves calm and being able to just be with things and see very clearly. When we are agitated and disturbed emotionally, or when we are restless or sleepy, any of these physical or mental disturbances, we can't see clearly. And the Buddha has this beautiful set of imagery about the five hindrances, where they're talking about a pond where when restlessness is like the wind blowing across the pond and you can't see, and sleepiness is like algae growing across the pond and you can't see through. Desire is like beautiful colored dyes in the pond that you're just looking at all that, but you're not really seeing through it. So it
calm abiding is when we can let all that settle. The heart can become still. We see how this kind of agitation and restlessness is such a disease of our culture. One of my little games is that when I'm waiting in the checkout line, to watch how the checker's mind and how the person behind the counter can't stay on task. They can never just check out a person's bunch of things, take their money, ring it up, hand them the receipt. Just watch. And or just for you. You know, can you get them to just do... Now, the phone rings, they're distracted, they start talking to someone else. It's just, that's the way we are, you know. And cell phones and, you know, smartphones. The phones are getting smarter, people are getting dumber, you know. Undermine our capacity for this, the capacity to just be with something. You know? The Buddha taught concentration practices were very, very powerful. And he talks about these supernormal powers that come from it. Whether those are true or not, I don't know. But they all depend upon a very powerful level of concentration. And again, to turn our will and our lives over to that is to let go of the distraction and say, I'm going to stay on task. I'm just going to, whether it's doing the dishes, whether it's, you know, taking care of a child, whether it's reading a book, whether it's meditating, it's to stay on task. You know, it's interesting to me that when I had a day job, which thankfully I don't have anymore, thanks to all of you, I spent much more time surfing the internet than I do now. I was at work. I was connected to the internet. Is this not when most people do, you know, their fantasy team and their shopping and they're reading the news? Because you're at work, you know. If you're at home, for me anyway, when I'm at home, I have better things to do than sit around and surf the internet, you know. And I don't waste my time with it. Well, so this is kind of the Eightfold Path as higher power.